Hello. Hello.
Okay. So let's go here. Okay, so I'll be starting. Hi, I'm Jan Urbański. I will be talking about a project that possibly will or could replace the genetic query optimizer in Postgres. So if you want to get the slides and follow them while I talk, you can get them from that address, if stuff will be too little on the screen or so on. If you want to try the code out, you can get it from there and build it. If you build it against a server that has assertion enabled, it will be extremely slow and it will write stuff to your TMP directory. Don't do that. It's going to be awful. But if you compile it against the normal server, it should run more or less. And the code's quite ugly still, so yeah, don't be scared.
But other than that, it's great.
Yeah, other than that, it should plan your query at least, right? If you do a select, it should, in a reasonable time, I guess, plan something. I guess. So yeah, I'm gonna talk a bit about what is the problem that this thing is trying to solve. Then about how it's trying to solve that. And then a quick comparison with Gecko, because that's what it's supposed to be a replacement for. And then a few words about what's coming in the future, because the code is ugly still and has deficiencies. So yeah, the problem basically is that you have a large query and there's a lot of joins there, and you need to determine in which order you want to execute them for it to be fast. Right? So part of doing the query planning, I don't know if you've been to Robert's talk about the query planner. So part of the job of the planner is determining in which order your relations are going to be joined. And usually you have quite a few of those orders possible that yield the same results, and you want to pick the one that's going to be fastest. This actually is a problem, and more so, because there are, you might think, yeah, I joined, like, I don't know, five relations, six relations, but there are people who join like 100 relations, and automatically generated queries can give you, like, if you have some kind of a point and click UI that generates a query for you, you can get a very large join. And Postgres does some things like if you have a subquery, it usually is going to get pushed up to the higher level of the query, and it's going to be transformed into a join, right? So if you have a subquery, a select inside the select, this usually actually is going to be a join, right? So you might be joining more relations than you actually think you are. So the optimal join order is to find it. That's an NP hard problem, so you can't do this, right? And that's very easy to check if you turn off the things that Postgres does to prevent bad things from happening. You cannot plan a large join. You're probably run out of time, if not memory. So that's a basic problem. It's an NP hard problem. You have to do some heuristics, something that's not like just check every possibility to plan to come up with a reasonable plan, right? Then another problem is that not all join orders are valid. So if you have a query and you have lots of relations, you can't just pick any join order, because there are, if you have outer joins, like left joins or full outer joins, they enforce some restrictions on what can you join first and what can you join to that afterwards. And another thing is that usually if you join, you usually have some kind of restriction clause with that join. So if you join A to B, you usually say where A dot something equals B dot something, because otherwise you just get a Cartesian join, like every pairing, which usually is not what you want. And that tends to be very big. So usually you want to join these and not the, if you have lots of them, you want to join the ones that have actually restriction clauses. So yeah, How do you solve NP hard problems? You basically come up with an algorithm that does something that ideally you would control the error, that the maximum error that you can get. So the Postgres for joining more than a certain amount of relations, which by default is, I think, 16, uses a module called Gecko. So what does Gecko do? So Gecko is a genetic algorithm. What it does is it takes the relations that you want to join. It joins them in basically any order. So the first valid order that's sensible, it just takes it as the starting point. And then it starts mutating that join order and seeing how much does the resulting plan cost. So how much would it cost to execute that plan, at least by estimates. And then these mutations, so the genetic algorithm makes these mutations and then crosses them and then uses the standard genetic programming techniques to come up with a plan that's fittest, which is cheapest. Gecko calls that fittest, but actually what's optimized is the cost of obtaining the final relation. So that's Gecko. And so Gecko apparently doesn't get a lot of love. And if you look inside, it's not quite as ugly as my code, but it's not very nice. I mean, there are ifdefs all over the place, and half the code is ifdefed out, actually. On the wiki, there is a to-do item to just get rid of it. I mean, you can't get rid of it, otherwise people will not be able to plan their queries. So, yeah, but no one wants to fix Gecko, apparently. I mean, improve it, at least. Because no one really cares about it enough. As long as it's working, I guess people are quite happy and don't want to touch this. Also, there are some kind of deeper problems. So this algorithm initially was used to solve the traveling salesman problem. And it was just mapped, the join ordering problem was mapped into TSP. And then the same algorithm was used. So it's not obvious that this is the best way to do this. It's probably not bad. People are not complaining that much, as far as I know. But still, it's not that good. And some people suggest, and there are techniques that are designed by people specifically for join ordering, so that these should work better. And actually, another thing is that the planner does some things specifically to help Gecko work, which is kind of, for someone who writes a plugin to replace that, that's not very nice because the planner helps the other guy and he doesn't help you. So it's like the planner is not really agnostic towards the plugin that will be used for query planning. So there are parts in the planner that say, we do this because Gecko needs that. So it's kind of like violating that abstraction that you have the module for join ordering and the planner just does his stuff and delegates that to the module. The planner actually knows, helps Gecko a bit. So what's the other solution? The other solution is simulated annealing. And it's one of the solutions, of course, but the one that people, I guess, got quite excited about, and the one I tried to implement. So what is simulated annealing? There have been papers written on using simulated annealing. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. But there are people actually writing scientific papers on that. So there is at least theoretical base for that. You can go and read all of them. If you go to any, paper, I don't know, ACM or something, or conference proceedings or something, usually there's a lot of them, right? There's a guy who wrote a prototype for that and posted it on Hackers, and I read through that, and I took some ideas from that, I guess. So it's been floated around. It wasn't very, it was just a prototype, so nothing really intended to work. But it's feasible at least. And people have been talking on Hackers. There's a thread linked from the to-do item to remove Gecko, so we can find that. Okay, so what is simulated annealing? So Wikipedia, which provided the image, I think, it tells you that annealing is a term from metallurgy, and it's basically taking your object made of metal, heating it up, and then gradually cooling it down so that the crystal structure stays or reaches the lowest possible energy, right? So the state of the crystal has the least energy, and then this makes the material more durable. Okay, so basically you heat something up, put a lot of energy, make the metal, make the crystal have a lot of energy, and then cool it down so that those crystals kind of settle down in a smooth state. And the analogy holds for the algorithm. So the algorithm, called by analogy simulated annealing, is that you have a system that you want to optimize. You have a value called temperature. So you start, and you have some initial temperature. And you have some random state of your system. And then you make changes to that system. And if the change makes the result better, so in our terms it would mean that the resulting plan is cheaper, then it's fine, then you're happy, you just take it. But if the plan is more expensive, you sometimes say, okay, I'm going to do that step. I'm going to take this plan into consideration, and we'll see why this happens. So the probability, so what happens is you have a state, and you take steps. You mutate your plan in some way, right? And then if it's downhill, if the plan is better, you're happy. You just take the new plan. If the new plan is worse, you accept it with some probability. So you roll a dice, and you either throw that new state away, or you say, okay, that's my new state. I'm gonna take my next step from that state. So the probability is this term gives you that. And as you can see, there's the temperature here. So the higher the temperature, the more probable it is that you will accept a state that is uphill, that worsens your local state. And the term here is the difference between the costs. So if the cost difference is big, so if you made it worse by a large number, then you're less likely to accept it. And you take moves like, yep.
Well, it would seem like a problem with that is that the scale of the cost numbers can vary over several orders of magnitude.
So you mean the scale of that versus that?
Yes.
The thing is, you need to, what you do is you set the temperature in the same unit as the costs. So then this becomes kind of...
But some plants have very low costs and some plants
yeah.
have high costs, right? I mean,
yeah, but you basically operate everything, you operate with the scale, with the same scale as the planner does, so a unit of cost. And the temperature is expressed with the same unit. I mean, I don't really see where
like
the...
If you're scanning a table that's 50 kilobytes,
yeah,
then the same temperature will have a very different effect than if you're scanning a table that's a terabyte.
Okay, what do you mean by have different effect?
Well, so if the temperature is, you know, a million,
yeah,
right, but you're scanning a very small table, then the cost might only be negative by, say, 50 or 100.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a very big one, it might be negative by 3 million.
Yeah.
Right? So those will produce very different ratios.
Yeah. So the trick is to set the temperature somehow based on the cost of your first plan. So you kind of scale that to the starting point. And then if your costs generally are small, then your temperature will start off small. And then this
yeah.
kind of scales out.
Yeah. Is that what you do?
Yes. Yeah, I'm gonna talk about, I mean, that's the general idea. I'm going to talk about how things are done then. It's actually what the paper tells you to do, I guess, I think. And so, yeah, you take these moves, right? And you take them uphill or downhill, and you're less and less probable to take them uphill because the temperature gradually falls because you heat it up your system and then you're gradually cooling it off. The moves are made until equilibrium is reached, and that's another thing you have to have in your algorithm. Say, okay, this is equilibrium. I won't do more moves. The system is stable now. And once you say that the system is frozen, the algorithm ends. So I'm going to explain all these terms shortly. So how does the algorithm go? You pick a random state. Then you take a new state. If the new state is acceptable according to that formula, right? You keep it. If not, you just discard it. You do that until the system reaches equilibrium. So you kind of do these steps and do uphill and downhill. And that's the inner loop. You reduce temperature after each iteration of that. So you heat stuff up. You wait for it to settle. Lower the temperature. Wait for it to settle and gradually go down. And you put an outer loop while this becomes frozen, so until reducing temperature doesn't make sense anymore, basically, and then you return whatever state you are in. Right, so that's it looks more or less easy, right? It's the algorithm is not very complex. So if you wanna have simulated annealing, you have to implement these things. You have to have an initial state. You have to know how to generate subsequent states from that. You need to say what is acceptable, what is the equilibrium, what is the freeze condition, and you have to know how do you lower your temperature. You have to have these somehow in the code. Yes? Oh, I don't know. Okay.
If the new plan is cheaper than the old plan, do we always accept it?
Yes. Yep. Yes?
So in a lot of simulated annealing systems, to avoid the situation that they were talking about earlier, where if you scale your temperature, you get trapped in the local minimum, you have random restarts or parallel random starting points.
No, I'm not. Some papers say that you can combine that and you can do various traversals of the solution space,
yeah,
like you said.
You do a bunch at the same time where you have one that randomly restarts and then you have a population at the end that you pick up.
Yeah, you could do that. And I guess it shouldn't be that difficult to add if it proves usable. But no, this just does one pass. So basically, these are the parts we need to implement. Take the state, know how to generate moves, know what's acceptable, tell when do you reach equilibrium, how do you lower your temperature, and when the stuff's frozen. These are the functions you need to write, basically, to have your algorithm, and then it's just implementing that loop. An example, so how you could think about how this goes. This is me using GIMP badly. If this is the solution space, so each point here, the higher it is, the more costly the plan. Okay? And the red line is the path that your algorithm takes while wandering around the solution space. So you start at some random point, and then you go. You usually go downhill, but because of that random uphill move, that possibility of taking uphill moves, you won't get. So imagine this hole here is more shallow than this, right? So you will go down here, but you will not get trapped in this minimum, because the temperature is high at the beginning. You have this chance of jumping out of here, and possibly finding something with an even lower state. So the thing is, because a simplistic algorithm would be you take a state and then you go until it gets better and better and better, and when you're done with that, when some time would expire, you just take the last step. But that gets trapped if you have a shallow local minimum. You will get trapped in that. And if there's something way better waiting for you, you know, over the hill, you want to be able to jump out of that local minimum. And that's more or less annealing, right? You have this hot system, you can jump out of this local minimum, and then you should gradually settle down with the something reasonably good. So how does this work with Postgres, right? Because that was the theory. That's what you can read in the papers. How would this work with Postgres? So what's specific about Postgres with that? So the original, the papers, usually, they tell you you consider, for instance, each type of join as a separate kind of a move, right? So if you have a join and it's a nested loop, a move could be changing that nested loop to a merge join. So with Postgres, that's not really easy, I think, because when you join relations, when you use that make join rel function, that's kind of central to all that, it considers all the paths in Postgres lingo at the time. So you can't really easily tell it, so you have this, now consider just this other path. When you try to join two relations, the resulting relation already has all the possible paths considered. So that means that you just do more step. Each state is like more generic. That's fine, I guess. Also, that is symmetrical. So in the original paper, you can have A join B, and you can try to do B join A. So like make B the outer relation of the join. In Postgres, these are symmetrical, so we'll get the exact same relation when you try to join like symmetrical, when you try to join AB and BA. So that's another difference. You can have join order constraints, which the papers I read kind of skim over that. They just say, let's assume you have equality inner joins all the way. And that's good for a scientific paper. Sure, and you can build on top of that, and you can do, you know, projection and stuff, but stuff gets involved with functions and left joins and so on. And the planner also has a habit of keeping the list of all the relations it's built, and sometimes it, under the hood, changes that into a hash of all the relations that it's ever built. So if you're taking a step and then taking it back, or taking two steps and then want to go back to some other step, you have to basically cheat the planner into thinking this never happened. So Gecko does that, and simulated annealing does that. How does this work specifically? This word here, it appears in one of the papers, and I took this as the name of this project. I don't know what I.O. is from. I think it's the initials of the guys that proposed this specific flavor. But yeah, it sounds better than just SA. So four letters are better and still short. In there, I represent my states as trees, because in Postgres, relations are usually, you have this tree somewhere. I mean, the paths kind of build that tree. But I do this, I mean, I have a tree explicitly, like a separate data structure. And I do this because the algorithms from the papers usually operate in trees. So having an explicit tree and then like nodes and like children was easier for me. So each state is a tree. The leaves of that tree are the basic relations that you join. And the internal nodes are the joined relations. So I'll have an example in a minute. And the root of the tree is the current result. So this is a query tree. These are base relations, like this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They are numbered. This is how the planner refers to relations when it's planning. So this means that this relation is a join between 2 and 3. And the name of that thing is 2, 3. And that's a set. Because since that's symmetrical, joining 2 to 3 yields 2, 3. And joining 3 to 2 yields 2, 3, because it's symmetrical. So these are sets. And then that's how a query tree would look like if you try to join six relations. This is how it might be built. This means join this to that, this to the result, this to the result, and so on and so on. And it doesn't tell you how, because that's like inside. There are all paths, all possible ways to do that join are considered in this. And if you zoom, you see that the relations have this number here. This is the plan. This is the cost of getting to that relation. This is actually, I mean, there's this cost, the startup cost and the total cost. I'm just considering the total cost. That's what Gecko does, and that's just easier for now. Right? So this means that this building this relation would cost this. Scanning or getting at this relation would cost this, and building this would cost that. So that's the query tree. So when you work with them, when you do stuff with them, there are some properties that you should be aware of. They are symmetrical, so these two are exactly the same. This is the same. This is the same state, right? If you join 1 to 2, 3, or if you join 2, 3 to 1, that's actually the same thing. You can forget about these, because the only thing that matters is how the tree looks like and what's in the leaves. So this has to be 2, 3, and all paths will be considered, so this you actually can forget about this. This determines your state. So that's another thing. And yeah, each node has a cost. Even if it's not fully built yet, each node has its own cost. Yes?
Why do they have the symmetrical property? I thought it mattered which table is the inner table, which one is
yeah.
The
so the thing is, Postgres use, well, okay, there is this routine in the planner, there's this function to take two relations and give you the joined relation, the outcome of a join. And this function considers both A to B and B to A. So all possibilities of doing A to B and B to A are considered with that. So that's why if you're using that and it's good using that, because the planner already considers lots of things in that function, then your algorithm has this property of it being symmetrical. Which all the theoretical research does not have this property. I mean, they assume you don't have this property. It's like this is Postgres specific, and I don't know how this changes whether it's the algorithm is still useful or how do you tune the parameters. I don't know that. So you have your query trees, and now you want to do the steps. Like I said, you have to do these things. So these basically are easy. That's easy. I'm going to just skim over them. And that's hard. So taking steps, generating steps is hard. The rest is easy, I guess. So let's go over the easy ones first. So the initial state, you just do what Gecko does. I mean, I tried just doing a random join, just taking whatever and joining it up, as long as it's semantically valid. But then you get a completely stupid query with lots of cross joins, because you just take two random relations, and if they don't happen to have a restriction clause, so if you like join A, B, C, D, E, and F, and in the query you have A.x equals B.x and B.y equals C.y and so on, if you join A to E, you will get a cross join. And so the initial state would be completely way off. So I just went with what Gecko does, which is build one that's sensible, at least, at the beginning. So you have an initial state. You just steal what Gecko does. It's easy. So now, how do you accept? So that's given explicitly by the algorithm. You just say that the probability of a move being accepted is this. That's easy. Cool. How do you lower the temperature? That's very easy. Oh, actually, it's based on the number of initial relations, not the cost. I don't know why they did this. It might be interesting to try to scale this with the cost and not the number of relations.
Maybe the cost of sequentially scanning each of the base tables or something like that.
Something. I mean, tie it to the cost at least, because right now it's only tied to the number of relations, which is what the original research suggests.
Yes, but again, the original research is, you know, they're doing it in a scientific theoretical environment, so they're not considering the fact that the original relations might be radically different in size.
They actually are. No, they are considering lots of, I mean, that they are considering, that they can be different in size, that you can either have index scans or you know, merge joins, all that. But
the other way that you could do it is to normalize the difference between the costs.
Against what? Normalize to what?
Well, I don't know, like take the cost prev minus the cost new and divide by the cost prev or something like that.
Okay, so like 2:1. Yeah.
I don't know if that works.
Okay, that's actually, the initial temperature isn't that important actually, because it drops off anyway, and you just want to start high and go low.
Yeah,
yes?
That's what I was about to say. If you just set it high enough in the beginning, you're just going to jump around more in the beginning, but
It falls, so. And there's geometrical backup, so it gets multiplied by a number in each step.
It only matters if the initial temperature is too low, right?
Yeah, if it's too low, you're not going to do the steps. If it's very high, you're just going to accept stupid things, but that's usually not very bad.
Well, if it's too high, then you're effectively starting in several places, which is kind of good.
Kind of. The places are nearby, right? Because if you have this analogy of the plane, they are nearby. They're not necessarily spread out. But I'll have a slide about that later on. So what is an equilibrium? That's very simple. You just say, if I have like 10 relations, I'll reach equilibrium after n times 10. So I always do 30 loops of that inner loop. So that's completely determined by the number of initial relations. That's a simple thing, but that's what the people did, and they got good results. And at this point, I don't want to complicate my life anymore. And now when does the system freeze? So we say that it has frozen if the temperature is below 1 and some consecutive moves have failed. So if it's really cold, if it's below 1, you're very unlikely to accept uphill moves. And if you haven't found any downhill moves in like 3 or 4 consecutive moves, you just give up. So that's easy. It's not the difficult part. The difficult part is getting the next step out of the last step. And there are difficulties to that. So you can use different techniques, and I implemented different techniques, like experimenting with them. The thing is, if you want to take a step, you basically need to rebuild you want to have the cost of the root of the tree. So you need to rebuild the tree. And joining the relations is usually what comes up top in the profiling. So that's costly. Another thing is that if you have to, between steps, you have to release the memory you used for the last step. Because when usually the normal planner doesn't care about that. It just tries, and there are few joins, and it just takes up quite a lot of memory, but that's fine. But if you try lots and lots of joins, then you might run out of memory really quickly. So actually, if you try to run the standard planner without the Gecko safety valve, you will run out of memory before you run out of time. I mean, you will get OOM killed before you get bored, if you want to try that. So you need to free memory, and that's not always very easy, I guess, because I'll try to show why. The planner does, if it creates a query, it remembers that it created it for later reference. If you want to create it again, it just hands you the already created query relation, which is bad if you want to repeatedly plan, because you want to have a new one. You want to force it to do it again. So you have to kind of work around that. And there's this vague point at the bottom that means it's difficult to say. I mean, there's this plane that you wander around. And if you take, the thing is, it's not necessarily obvious what kind of mutation of these trees give you states that are close by. Because if you're just sampling randomly, then it doesn't make sense to do all that annealing stuff. You can just randomly sample. You need to do things that change it a bit at a time. So it makes sense to actually prefer downhill, but sometimes go uphill. So it's like you have to kind of have an idea of how are you sampling the solution space, not just building random trees, because then you lose the advantages of the algorithm. What's implemented in right now, and how does this work? So the first thing is just called move, because it was the first thing. It just takes two trees, it swaps them around, it recalculates the cost of the whole join. If it got something invalid, because there are join order restrictions, so if you just swap two subtrees around, you can have an invalid join somewhere, then it says the move failed. So it's as if it has been uphill and hasn't been accepted. If the cost of the new tree is acceptable, it's good. If not, not. So that's kind of simple. You take a tree. You choose two nodes. So you choose two subtrees, actually. So that's one subtree that's been chosen. That's the other one. You swap them around. So you put this 5 here, and you put this 1, 2, 3 here. So this means this becomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that part is kind of unchanged, right? So that's a move. We swapped these two around, and each time you recalculate everything from bottom up. So these are base relations, but you recalculate the costs of these. You take the cost of the root node, and then you have your cost on which you decide whether you accept it or not. And there are problems with that, which that's why others exist, because that didn't really work very good. First of all, if you pick a node, you can't pick any other node later on, because, for instance, if you pick that node, you can't really swap it with that node, because then you would kind of, I mean, that wouldn't make sense, like swap this with that, right? Because these are inner relations. So for a tree, that wouldn't make a difference, right, if you swap these two. So you can't pick a... Oops. Damn. Don't do that. You can't pick... If you pick a node, you can't pick a child node. You can't pick a parent node for the same reason, because the swap is symmetrical, so that's the same reason. You can't pick the root node, obviously. You can't pick a sibling node, because they're symmetrical. You will get the same result. So that narrows it down a bit. The changes are very big. So like this shuffles it very heavily. So you take, I'd say that it takes big steps. It moves, it changes the state very rapidly. So you that's just a gut feeling, but it just you don't take these little steps, but you just kind of probe it fairly randomly. Although it's not... I'm not really sure if that's the case. I'd have to try to do some graphing of the costs. I haven't done that yet. The thing is also, this might be invalid, so you might like build this, and then it turns out you can't redo that join. Because you should have joined something else before, because there's a left join somewhere or an anti-join somewhere, and then you suddenly recalculated a lot of things for nothing. Just have to throw it away. That doesn't make sense. You go back here, and you wasted a move, you wasted time, and so on. And any such failure means that the whole move is considered invalid. So if you fail anywhere, you just throw that move away. So it takes a lot of, especially with some schemas, with some queries, it takes a lot of, you have a lot of failures. You basically fail like 70% of the times. Yes?
Does it only consider movements that have join qualifications?
No. No, it does everything, and that's both good and bad, because usually if you create a cross join somewhere, you're usually gonna have something extremely costly. But then again, the idea is, yeah, that's gonna get discarded. Maybe you actually need that cross join, because then some other level works out better. That's the theory. I don't know how well this really works in practice. I'd have to some instrument it a bit more to see. So then there's another idea, something I called pivot, which is actually proposed in one of those papers. So you have something like that, so A join B, and then you join C into that, and you turn that into A join B join C. So that's exploiting the fact that the join operator is usually transitive, is the word. Associative. that usually you can do that. You just, instead of joining these two and then the third, you join these two and then the first. So in practice, it works like that. You choose one node, and you swap one of the children and one of the sibling, and the sibling. And the thing is that here I was trying to get away from the problem where I was failing a lot because one of the joins was invalid. So I was trying to do all possible pivots until one of them got valid, which might take a lot of time. So you take a tree, You choose a node, so let's say we chose this node, and then these are the valid pivot routes, let's say. You can try this, that, that, and that. You can't pivot over that because it has no children, right? You can't pivot the root because it has no siblings. And then you pivot, and that's how a pivot would look like. So it actually makes sense if you think about it. You took this 1, 2, 3, 4, and put it here, and you took this 6. Wait, I can do that. That's cool. Yeah, that's ugly. And this 6 went here, right? So it's like a swap, but you don't swap random stuff. You pick like a root of the pivot, and then you shift it around. So you do like local changes in the structure. And then if this fails, you pick another, and you do another pivot, and so on, until you run out of the pivot, until you run out of pivot roots for that move, and then you fail. So what went wrong with that? It's going to go like that. What I do and why it's wrong. So each move gives you a lot of possibilities, but then it's costly because you do a lot of things each move, so it goes slow. On the other hand, it does small things. It does small changes. So if you have this really stupid join somewhere that you really shouldn't be doing, then it's not going to break this up. It's just going to do small changes, and it's always going to be... You can optimize a bit, but you're not going to break this big bad join. So maybe you could, for instance, assess the cost. So not just take the cost of the thing, but the number of joins that are not crossed. So like prefer building joins in the cost function, not only in the beginning of the building of the tree, in the initial state, but prefer cross joins to not appear. You could kind of try to slide it inside, put it somewhere, but I'm not really sure how would that work. But that was a problem with that. The biggest problem is that it was slow. I thought it's going to be faster because I'm going to just do small changes, but it's slow. And you might recalculate the same exact join in many times, right? So you do this pivot, right? And then you recalculate this, for instance. This gets recalculated. And then you do another, and you recalculate this again because you throw away all inner nodes. You have your new tree structure, and you recalculate everything. So there's a lot of redundant computation going on, and that takes a lot of time. So recalculation, that was an attempt, the most recent one, an attempt of cutting down the number of recalculations. It is the same as move. It basically is just swapping subtrees, but it tries to keep the relations built. So if you already joined something, you keep it around. And that's where this thing that the planner just, if it has a relation with a given signature, like 1, 2, 3, it wants to keep it around. But I sometimes want to get rid of it. I sometimes want to get rid of just 1, 2. And this 1, 2, 3 points to 1, 2. So if you want to rebuild 1, 2, that's bad because if I throw it away, in the 1, 2, 3 has a dangling pointer somewhere and this things break. So I do a lot of ugly things in there. And the idea is to recalculate the joins in the like swap, recalculate to the common ancestor. If this succeeded, and only then, recalculate the rest. If not, you can throw them away, tell the planner to forget about them, and this will work for you. I'll show why. And there are some nasty things in that. So for instance, in order to selectively get rid of... So if you've had like lots of joint relations, you built a lot, and then you want to throw away just 3 of them, you want to release their memory because you want to release memory because you'll use a lot of memory during that. You can't just throw away everything like Gecko does. So each node in the tree got its own memory context, which is, if you're not familiar, it's if you do something in a memory context, the memory gets associated with that. And then you can tell Postgres to free all the memory that got associated inside that context. So you can have separate memory pools for each node of my query tree. And that was an idea of just zapping single relations when you need them. And you need to go into the planner inner structures and remove the join rails that you want to get rid of. So you reset their memory, and then you remove the notion of them from the planner, because then the pointer is invalid. You free the memory you point to. And that's nasty, and there are bugs there. It fails from time to time, so there are still bugs there. So again, you take this tree, you choose two nodes just the same. Like, for instance, you chose this and that at random. You swap them around, but so you haven't I haven't recalculated these yet, right? This is still 2, 3, even though these are 4 and 3. So I still have this relation built and in the planner. Then you recalculate these two, right? So these are recalculated, but these are still kept. Thing is, you can keep this and that, because you're sure they will not appear anywhere in this tree. So you keep them kind of separately. In your tree, you put these, but if any of them fails, then you can just get rid of them and kind of use these. So these two that were built, you can tell the planner they never existed. You can free their memory, and you're fine. You haven't broken anything. And this, yes?
The 3, 4 at the bottom on the right joins the 2, 3. How does that happen?
Because that's after you swap them around. Okay, so you swap these two around, and it's like that. But then one of these in this step, so let's say this is invalid. So that's invalid, so you put that back, but you still have your tree swapped. And then you would say the move failed, obviously. But then suppose that this did work, right? You then recalculate the rest up to the root. And if something fails here, you can just get rid of these two, and you can recalculate these two nodes. So you have less recalculation. So you still keep these, because in the new tree they're not going to appear. So you can just keep them in the planner. They're never going to be looked at. And the only ones you have to destroy, so in order to recalculate this one in this configuration, you had to zap this from the planner. So if it fails, you have to put that back in this configuration. Yes, this is the reaction I was waiting for. That's very bad, but I'm desperate. So yeah. But it kind of works more or less now. But it's faster than just the move algorithm.
I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I'm just wondering if there's somewhere we can avoid some of the
If you think about it, so problems. There are, the hacks are nasty. That's one thing. It doesn't speed it up as much, and it's not. If it would have been super cool, I could just say, let's make the planner like help with that, and let I try to convince you guys to put stuff in to help me. But it's not as good, so I'm not yet. I don't have ammo to kind of argue that. It doesn't solve the problem of having an invalid move, so you have failed moves, but you just fail cheaply. So this means you can take more moves before you run out of time or whatever. And because the way you build trees, because the way you start your initial state, it's usually like the tree is looks like that. It's left deep, so it rarely has branches like that's actually a left deep tree, right? Because that's symmetrical. These two are symmetrical, so this is like a deep line and just one relation on the side. So then the benefit is not that big, because the common ancestor is somewhere low and you recalculate all of stuff anyway. And also the thing is that the list or the hash table in the planner that keeps the relations gets created at the same time the relation gets created. So it gets done in the same memory context. So if you reset that context to get rid of the relation, you get rid of the links inside the list or the entries in the hash table. So I have to rebuild those in the right context every time, and it's preposterous. It's very bad. Okay, so how does this compare with Gecko? So It's a moderately big query. It's a fairly large query. The collapse limits are set to 100. So the thing is, my intuition is, I think that's true, that the bigger the tree, the bigger the benefit. Because if you have a small tree and you do these little changes, then you don't really get all the benefits of doing these large changes to the tree. Because you just fix up the local small tree, and the big picture stays bad. So collapse limits, I might just say a few words about them. If you have a large join with a lot of subqueries, for instance, the subqueries get transformed into joins, usually, but not all of them, because sometimes Postgres says, okay, if I transform these into a join, I will end up with a join that has, say, 100 relations. And this is bad because I don't want this big join, I guess, because then I would have to use Gecko, and Gecko is not good. So I'd rather just do those, I'd rather just plan this subquery as a subproblem and then treat it as a base relation. So kind of force the join order. Say, okay, I'm going to do the subquery first, plan it and execute it first, and then I'm going to use that as a building block for the big plan. So that wasn't good for me because I want to have big trees to have to explore them a lot, right? Because these small trees, if I fix them up, I won't be able to break the, I won't be able to fix the bad things that happen across trees. So I like a big tree to make these algorithms do their job. So I set them to 100, so it actually is a big tree. And I use the recalc algorithm because it's the only one that gives reasonable performance. And as you can see, it's a bit slower and a bit worse. So with Gecko, the average cost, that's over 10 runs of the, it's just analyze, and I'm taking the cost of the top node, and I'm using the XML explain option. That's a use case. It's easier than just parsing it out from the text, I guess. And that's the average time it took to plan that. So with Gecko, it's like that. And with simulated annealing, these are the factors that... So there are these knobs. What's the starting temperature? When do you freeze? What's the... when is equilibrium reached? So if you reach equilibrium after 4 steps and you reduce the temperature after... you multiply it by 0.6 each move, you get these results. So as you can see, if you reduce the temperature slowly, then there's a lot of steps to the algorithm because you end when you reach, it freezes when it reaches 1 with the temperature. So if you make this factor big, which means the temperature falls off slowly, it takes more time because it does all these computations. And also, the more loops, this just grows linearly. If you do twice as many loops, you actually got even more because I've bumped the temperature also. But this means 8 means you will do twice as moves as with 4, right? So that's pessimistic. But then to not make me very sad, I tried a really big query, the biggest one I had. And then it turned out that overnight, Gecko. So I before coming here, I woke up and I copied these into the presentation, and I was happy because I didn't even know before coming here if it's gonna suck completely or will I be able, without lying, to tell you that it does some good things. So the Gecko sucked apparently because it got bad results in a lot of time, probably because the collapse limit was so big, so it had to do all these recalculations. And probably because this is a very evil query, I'm going to mention the guy that gave me that query by name, to shame him, but it is bad. And then simulated annealing was decent, I guess. I don't know. These are some decent... It's better and it's faster. It's not very bad. You mean the time?
Yeah.
That's milliseconds, which would be...
Oh, all right.
Wait, no, it's from, no, that's from, that's seconds, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, given that before you were point something,
how many times did you, how many did you average?
10. So that probably, yeah, that's
125 seconds.
That's seconds. If you add that up, it should be all night, I guess.
Well, no, I agree. It's beating up on Gecko a lot.
It is. The thing is, it is better, but it doesn't matter if no one will wait that long for a query. So, yes?
How many relations altogether in this
collection? Oh, God, I can't tell you from the top of my head. I have the query somewhere. I could check that. I think the collapse limit was, all right, the total, you mean? I don't know. Yeah. I would say in the range of thousands, but I would have to check that. I can't remember.
The costs just seem amazingly low for that large.
True.
They had a problem that those queries, that the table doesn't contain anything, so it's just playing nest loops, if I remember it correctly. So it's just nest looping 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
But that's the planning cost. That's the planning. This is apparently the query has been generated by some software, and this is a real
world.
Yeah, there's no table.
No, there is no data. There is no data.
Okay. So that does
because the planner didn't.
You need to test it with the table populated because you get real answers.
True, and it would be useful to test running the query, and because I'm only measuring planning time, not the actual execution. Because if the execution time is off. From the the planning time is what matters, right? The execution is another matter. But then I'm only this cost, right? This cost is the cost from the planner, not from the executor.
Oh,
but then the
execution time matters too.
But then you don't care if the execution times are way off from the. If the planner told you this plan is really cheap, but then the executor made. It happened to be very, very expensive. That's not my fault. That's not my fault.
That's true. But on the other hand, if I might be willing to spend more time planning if it was going to reduce the execution time by more than the amount of additional time that I spent planning.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
On the other hand, I wouldn't want to spend a lot of extra time planning and only cut a very small amount off of the execution.
Yeah. So I crave real world test cases because I don't really work in a database shop, so these are stuff that people sent me, and if you have big queries, send them to me.
All you need really is fake the statistics so that you can.
I could fake the statistics,
yeah,
true.
Yeah, you really need some real statistics, otherwise the results don't mean.
Well, that might be something that you could acquire though, at least.
You might find that you're much better or much worse when you
true.
Have real
true. True.
Statistics in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You had that probability computation of when you go up and when you go down
yep.
with the E and everything. I'd love to see the same statistics applied to whether you choose random things to move between stages or actual joinable
right.
things between stages.
I'm not really sure if it's easy to just pick a relation and say what is it joinable with. You could loop over all the relations, and actually, you could loop over all the relations and ask whether it's joinable with that, with the other relation. But I think you need the whole tree to be built at that point because it asks for the path of the parent relation. So if it's like floating, if this relation has no valid parent, that doesn't really work. So that's an issue also. I think that's when anti-joins were introduced. It started looking at the cheapest path of something or the unique path, whether it can be made unique. And it does it by looking at the path that you don't necessarily have computed if you're doing evil things like that. There's a gotcha there.
It's sort of like when you're at the point where you're willing to go upward, I think you have more of a likelihood that you might want to consider Cartesian products. But as the temperature's coming down,
okay.
you should probably not be favoring
okay.
As much as you are.
Okay, I get that. Yeah, so that's more or less the idea of making the number of Cartesian joins part of the cost function. So we say if you have lots of Cartesian joins, you say these are not very good plans. Okay, something like that. Or maybe just make it independent. So you can go a bit uphill and you can go a bit up in the number of Cartesian joins, but not a lot. Maybe like okay, I just have like two more slides, but I'm running out of time also. So could this wait until I'm done? Sorry. Just a few words then. So first of all, I'd like to squeeze my master's thesis out of that, and that's why I'm doing that, because I'm not doing that for work. So, but also, I'd like to get some better transformation methods, because the ones currently are not very good. I'd like to cut down the number of useless computation, because it makes me really angry that it recalculates all that stuff. And I mean, it makes it slow also. If it's good, it would be nice for the planner to be as good to me as it is to Gecko, or at least, I don't know, I feel bad. So yeah, it should be, I mean, the goal is to be able to replace it. So if I'm really lucky, it might actually be possible to replace, or at least provide it as a contrib thing, and people can choose, right? So it gets some production testing. And the code's there, if you want to see. The source for the slides is there also. So yeah, if you wanna, there should be commits appearing there from time to time as I get them. Some acknowledgement. So this guy wrote the initial implementation. That's a variant of simulated annealing. You can find it in the archives. Tupo is something like simulated annealing plus. Andres, I know if he's on the okay. I hate you. Your query is like crazy. It's humongous, but then it's real world. Like some softwares.
They pulled up the real world query because it didn't get permission to publish the original one. But yeah.
So
can you provide statistic information?
I can try.
That would be great, I guess. So Robert gave me the slightly less crazy query. That's the one. that's the one that actually sparked the fix for Gecko to not make it. Yeah. So my supervisor for helping me out on that, my employer for letting me mess with that instead of doing my job. And if you want to read some papers, these are the papers that are good and it's like yeah. The slides will be there available. And I'm out of time, and okay. So, yes?
Yes, so it would seem that the most important thing about the algorithm is quality of the search space, not really how you go about finding things in it. Because if it looks like, that visualization you have, if it just looks like one funnel, then clearly it's going to work really well, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if it looks like a hole with like completely random, a plane with random walls,
you can.
It's not gonna work.
Yeah. So.
I'm thinking that if you could write like some function that evaluates the search space.
The function would be check all possible joins and graph the costs of them.
The search space is dependent upon the actual join. Right?
Yeah. So the search space is kind of given. You don't get to decide that. The cost is the height of the point and. Your move is the neighboring points. You could try to graph the path of your search, but you can't really graph the whole space because you'd have to consider all possible joins.
The other approach that I've that I know we've used in the past is to start off a whole bunch of people at random places.
Yeah, that's
all at the same time, and then do simulated annealing from there.
Yeah, that's one idea. Start off. That someone said that already. You start off with several points, and then you have a better chance of starting somewhere that actually has a good minimum.
There's cost associated with that, and since we don't do threads, you know.
You could do that in parallel. I guess that would be cool.
You
could also that tupo means that you start with simulated annealing, and then you switch to just going downhill all the time.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, so you go downhill, so you find some decent state, and then you start simulating anything from that.
Right, yeah.
That these are ideas. Yeah.
Have you considered just recording the best that you ever see as you?
That's done. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay.
You can end up high, but it is recorded.
And the next question is for the probability factor, have you considered putting a momentum element so that if you've just made a large reduction, you're more willing to go uphill again?
That's interesting. No one, I mean, I haven't read about anyone trying that, but it might be useful to, probably should be easy to implement and check if that helps. That's interesting.
But possibly, especially for the query of mine, interesting would be interesting is to, when you restructure the tree to early avoid join order restrictions, because at least for Gecko, that was the killing point that it never actually found any.
So your query is specific because you get lots of failures, and the restrictions are very harsh.
Yeah.
So I get like 70% of the moves sometimes are failed. So I don't really probe the space. I just stand and do stupid moves. That's.
But you could possibly separate the search space around the join order restrictions and do only inside the.
I'd love to do that, but I was unable because of these issues where you have to have the whole tree to be able to check. You know, I couldn't do that. Gecko rebuilds it from scratch all the time, so there is no and there was no interest of making it possible to just rebuild parts or just consider, you know, changes. Yeah.
Have you considered mining what Gecko's actually doing? Because I mean, it's effectively transforming the tree as well. You
said yeah.
You're interested in more interesting tree populations, like Gecko's.
I considered, I haven't, since it's better on many, I mean, since it's better at times, I'm more and more willing to actually try to translate what it's doing to what I'm doing. I tried looking at the code, haven't understood it fully yet. The big difference is that it does rebuild it from scratch all the time. So instead of keeping the tree, it keeps like a signature of that tree. But I don't really know how the mutations it's doing map to my tree changes. So, yeah, I have to do that eventually.
Yeah, I mean, the mutations are basically treatment.
Yeah, exactly. That's it's more or less. I mean, with the last algorithm I do something more than Gecko because I actually rebuild parts of it.
Right.
So that's different. But the other ones, it's you could map it more or less one to one. So you could build a tree out of Gecko's genome, and the other way around, I guess. I'll have to do that. Yeah?
One of your slides mentioned something about more support from core. I actually find it really interesting that you're able to do all of this outside. You have enough information to be able to test algorithms and test things outside.
Yeah, it is quite well modularized. So, I mean, Gecko is supposed to be a module. It could be like a module like that. Apart from these bits when the planner helps and I have to work around them, you basically get defined inputs and outputs and you can do that.
The only thing I wonder is you're starting from this XML representation of a plan. I wonder if there isn't some degrees of freedom that you don't know are there because you're trying to reconstruct an equivalent plan, but you don't know that there are some other meta information that would allow you to
I didn't get that. Could you? Okay, so I start with a join rel actually, just like Gecko does. The starting points are exactly the same. No, the XML is just I'm just to get these numbers.
Oh, okay.
That's I'm like issuing a query and parsing the XML instead of parsing the text. It's just. Okay. So yeah, it's late, and if anything, I'll be here. So just talk to me. Thanks.